Weekend Edition is sponsored in part by a grant from Hoffer Glass Company. Good afternoon. You're listening to Sunday at Noon. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. Sunday at Noon is a program sponsored as well by the KUAC Programming Fund and its contributors. This afternoon on Sunday at Noon, kids and drugs in Fairbanks. For the next hour, we'll look at the problem, the scope of the problem, and we hope some ways to help kids off of drugs and help kids not get involved with drugs in the first place. I have assembled a panel today for the program on Sunday at Noon on kids and drugs to introduce you. My first guest is Mary Ann Turkle. She is a substance abuse counselor with Milam Recovery Center here in Fairbanks, formerly with FNA Treatment Program. She's been working with teens, alcohol, and drugs since 1982. Richard Cummings is with us. He is chief of police for the city of Fairbanks. And Terry Solomon, substance abuse prevention specialist for Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. Terry is responsible for coordinating and assisting the implementation of the substance abuse curriculum district-wide. Our last guest is Paula, the parent of a teen who is recovering from drug and alcohol abuse. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining me today on Sunday at Noon.
Good afternoon.
I want to begin with a general picture, if we can, of the problem of teens and drugs in Fairbanks. And Mary Ann, can I begin with the question to you? What's the biggest drug problem for kids here in our town?
Surprisingly enough, I think, Susan, the biggest problem with adolescents as well as with adults in Fairbanks is alcohol. And that's also the biggest problem, by the way, in the whole state of Alaska and also in the rest of the United States. I think sometimes we tend to focus on the drugs of the moment, the fads, the crack of today, the PCP, the LSD of yesterday. And whatever the drug of the moment is, that's the one we tend to think is the absolute worst for everybody. But unfortunately, we tend to neglect the fact that alcohol is here. It's a legal drug for adults. It's readily available. Almost all of the kids I see have started their drug career with the drug alcohol, and they've started that at an early age. Too often what parents say is, well, thank goodness my son's not on drugs. It's only beer. A few beers can't hurt, or a little bit of alcohol won't hurt. And unfortunately also, if they've gone to outside agencies for help, many times they've been told, don't worry, this is a rite of passage of adolescence. In fact, alcohol is the most dangerous drug of all. And I've just read a survey which stated that 66% of our high school seniors have become intoxicated, that's more than five drinks on one occasion, within the last few weeks, while other studies show that the number of kids using other drugs, such as marijuana, has been declining steadily since 1977. I think the reason for that is, again, we've put all of our focus on other drugs, and we have made an impact. We've done an excellent job. We've neglected, however, in many cases, even mention alcohol. And that's particularly unfortunate, especially in Alaska, where we have the highest per capita consumption of alcohol in the entire United States.
So I hear you saying we've got two problems. One is with kids drinking before they can handle it, and the second is a culture, or at least a home life, which says, it's not so bad.
That's right. And I think our community is one that thinks it's not so bad. And if not our community only, just look at some commercials that you see on television. The commercials using dogs for spokespeople, the commercials using rock music, skateboarding, surfing-type motifs. Those commercials are made not to appeal to us, but to the next generation of drinkers, the 8-year-olds, the 12-year-olds, the 14-year-olds out there in the audience.
Chief Cummings, is that, in your estimation, the chief problem, alcohol?
I'd have to agree that for minor violations, alcohol violations, it's probably the number one problem. Our officers respond to a given number of parties, especially on weekends where youths are at and alcohol is involved. Our arrest statistics won't show the problem because there's not a lot of arrest made, probably because of the resources. But it's definitely attributes to a number of calls for service. With serious crimes, the in youth, which is only about probably less than 3% of the youth population, drugs, cocaine, marijuana, cocaine, are the causation factors. The recent or last year's murder of a cab driver was caused by a 16, 17-year-old, was caused by persons that were committing robbery to trade for drugs. Last summer, we had a gang of juveniles that were in the area of 13, 14 years old committing a number of burglaries, a series of burglaries, and including one where they planned to, if they had to, kill a night caretaker of this church. They planned to burglarize. These group were trading the money and the stolen property for drugs. On a nationwide study that was done, they found that those using marijuana were committing, had the crime rate three times higher than those that were not using marijuana. Those that were taking pills was even higher, and those who were using cocaine was about three times higher than those using marijuana. In fact, that the study that was done, a sample, that 1.3% of those population that was using cocaine were responsible for about 40% of the serious crime, and that's the robberies and burglaries and the felony assaults.
There's a clear relationship between drugs and crime among teens.
Yes, there is.
As well as adults.
Studies that have been done of adult inmates that are incarcerated for robberies and burglaries will admit that they started, as an adolescent, started using alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, which leads to offenses, misbehavior in school, truancy, smoking, improper sexual behaviors, and so forth. Starts at a very young age and just escalates as they get older.
I want to look at the starting and average age factor in a second. Terry Solomon, have you any thoughts about alcohol in the schools as compared to other drugs or the extent of drug use in the school district, so we can get kind of a full picture around the table here?
I think that as far as drug use goes, alcohol is a major factor. As I like to look at it as school-age kids, it's hard to tell what's being used in the schools. We have some statistics for kids who are caught, but it's not real accurate as far as what's going on in schools.
Paula, any thoughts about alcohol from your perspective?
My daughter told me that she started actually drinking alcohol. Beer was what she started with, probably when she was 12 or 13. That went into rum and coke. And from there, it was friends who gave her the marijuana and the cocaine. So I think alcohol is where it started for her. The one thing that Chief Cummings said, interesting, what I've heard from my daughter, and of course I have to believe what she tells me, that's as far as I know, she was given a lot of the drugs that she got. Didn't have to give sexual favors or this sort of thing. She didn't, to my knowledge, do any crimes to get. It was something that was very readily available. It's kind of like when we were children, the guys would take you to the movies. Today, the guys have the cocaine available for you to use. And that's very frightening to me.
Let's look at the age of starting drugs. Marion, you were talking the other day, figures that certainly made my eyes open wide. Can we take a look at when children are starting to use drugs in Fairbanks?
Sure. There was a study done over the past several years. In fact, there were two studies that came out of the University of Alaska Anchorage by Dr. Bernie Siegel. And he pinpointed the age of 13, which is junior high age, as the age most Alaskan kids begin to experiment, begin their drug use. Nationwide, it's about the same. We like to think that we in Alaska are a little ahead of the rest of the world, but in fact, we're right on target with the rest of the United States. When the kids that I see, though, are kids that are in treatment, they have begun their alcohol and drug use before the age of 13. In other words, the further you can push that age back, and 13, 14, 15, the better off you are. Most of the kids I've seen have begun their alcohol use at 2, 6, 8, in fact, the majority of them before the age of 10. And you have to think about this. Where does the average 10-year-old or even 12-year-old get alcohol? They're a little too young. They don't belly up to the bar. Nobody believes they're of legal age. They don't get served anywhere. They don't have clubs that they can go to. So where do kids this age get alcohol? Well, they get it from us. They get it from our homes. If we're not careful and we're not watching, they can take it when we're not aware. Or if we keep a dry home, perhaps they can get it from neighbors or friends or older friends. It is so available and so accessible that once a child begins to drink, we used to think that the damage had to go on for many years before anybody had a problem. But kids go downhill real quick. About a year to year and a half from beginning your drug use, you're going to see a lot of problems in kids, whereas adults, we can afford to take a little longer. They can't.
Is that because their brains and bodies are still forming?
Absolutely. They're not developed yet. They don't have the muscle mass. They don't have the weight. They don't have the social development, emotional development. It hits them very hard. The other thing we don't consider is what's a safe dose of alcohol for adults can be very dangerous for kids. And so we tend to think, well, if Dad can drink a couple of beers with no harm, then Junior can. In reality, that couple of beers could be fatal to Junior, and we never think of that. What happens once a kid begins to drink, the first drink begins to change us, begins to affect our brains, our decision-making capabilities, the way we think, the way we reason. It sets up a situation where values are relaxed, moral standards are relaxed, people begin to run around with an accepting atmosphere. In other words, their peers tend to be accepting of this kind of behavior, and it's only a small step from accepting alcohol-related misbehavior to the behaviors that Chief Cummings was talking about, to where people actually go out and commit crimes for drugs. In other words, they start with alcohol. They're in a drug-taking environment. Their values go downhill. Their grades become very dysfunctional, and then they become open to the possibility of taking other drugs.
Who's using drugs among teens in Fairbanks?
That's a very frightening question. I certainly didn't think my child was. Now, looking back on it, I think there's a great majority a great group of children out there who are using it. It's a peer pressure thing. If Johnny in fifth grade gets a hold of a beer and he can sneak it into the garage, well, come on over and, you know, let's taste it. As they get into junior high and high school, I think it is, the children believe that it's okay. It's all right. You're at the ski hill. You see Mom and Dad sitting around drinking. They have a glass of wine, a bottle of beer. Well, why can't you go out in the parking lot and have one, too? You know, and too often parents, like Marianne was saying, oh, come on, you know, my 15-year-old drank a beer, so I caught him drinking a beer. Is that a big deal? Mm-hmm. I think it's a big deal now, yes. I think it's very frightening, particularly when you look at it, if you look at it as I've begun to look at it, as alcoholism is a disease, addiction, if you look at it from the viewpoint that our children, if they have a hereditary factor involved, if they possibly can become alcoholic, and they don't even know this. You know, if we knew they had a chance to get cancer or heart disease or whatever, we would tell them early on, you know, take care of your body, do this, do that for your body. Oh, we don't do that.
Oh, that's very much in the closet, so to speak, in mm-hmm. our society. I mean, you don't say that Grandpa George was an alcoholic or that Uncle Henry, who right. was the kid's beloved uncle, was an alcoholic. Probably 50 years ago, you wouldn't say that Uncle Henry had died of cancer either.
That's right.
But it is it's something for people to get over, to be able to say that. Any other comments from any of you on who among teens and children are using drugs? I want to get a picture for our audience to hold in mind.
Well, I think from the police perspective, what the officer sees on the street is the very serious abuser, the one that is probably on the low socioeconomic plane that is supporting the drug habit by either selling other drugs to other persons or committing street crimes, property crimes, robberies. What the police officer doesn't see is the child that supports their habit by either employment, or has parents that can afford to give money, or they have the cars, the clothing, and everything else. That's probably a problem that is probably the most difficult to recognize.
We're talking on Sunday at noon today about kids and drugs in Fairbanks. You just heard from Chief Richard Cummings from the Fairbanks Police Department. Paula, the mother of a recovering child, is with us. Mary Ann Turkle from Milam Recovery Center, and Terry Solomon from the Fairbanks North Step Borough School District. Terry, you were about to make a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that some people tend to think that it's other groups of kids that do it, not the kind of kids that their children hang around with, or my kids, you know. And what we find statistic-wise and people in recovery centers, that it's all races, all economic levels. You name it, there's drug problems there. It's not just an easy place to single out a certain group of people.
That's right. We like to say this is an equal opportunity disease.
Right.
Anybody can get it, and anybody does. And having those myths and misconceptions are very damaging, because a lot of the kids I see, when I start questioning them about their drug and alcohol use, they get real offended and they say, I'm not an alcoholic. If you want to see an alcoholic, go down on 2 Street. I don't walk into walls. I don't walk into buildings. So that's their measurement. And what we have to do is change the way we define alcoholism and drug addiction. We used to think only middle-aged white males came down with those diseases, because those were the only kind of people we saw going into treatment centers. And there was a variety of reasons for that. And I think the most important one that I can point to was the age of the onset of drinking some years ago was adulthood. So it did take a long time for you to develop the disease. The other factor was the only drug available to many people was the drug alcohol. Now you're seeing people start at an earlier age. All of the kids I see are polydrug abusers. In other words, I've never seen a child who just uses one drug. I've seen adults who stick to one, have their favorites, and that number is getting a lot smaller. But kids use a number of drugs, usually 4 or 5 of them. So they go downhill a lot quicker. And I think the danger is, like Terry was saying earlier, is that we have this idea of only certain groups of people have problems, and we kind of close our eyes to our own kids' problems, and then, consequently, we're closing our eyes to our own kids' help. We don't think there's any help because we think they don't fit the mold.
Mm-hmm. That, in my case, it was very interesting to me to think that my child could have gotten involved because, quote, she came from a very strong, happy home, very involved family life. Her friends were from very nice homes. I couldn't believe that she would choose to go out and use drugs. You know, it not my child. My child would not do that. So when we found out, we were flabbergasted. We could not believe that it could happen to us. As Terry and Chief Cummings said, it was the kids that are running around in the black leather jackets with the greasy hair down, you know, downtown.
Right.
Just didn't expect it to be in our home.
Richard Cummings, I have a quick question for you, because I'm sure people will be sitting in their living rooms and wondering, do we have a crack and heroin problem in this town? And does it affect kids?
Well, we definitely have a drug problem. The majority of drugs seized in arrests and search warrants is cocaine and marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Very little heroin, some LSD, others, but its majority is cocaine and marijuana.
Okay, just get that in people's minds. There have been a couple of mentions in this portion of the hour about kids being drug affected more quickly, kids going downhill more quickly than adults. I want to know what happens to a youngster in terms of schoolwork, in terms of normal activities, whatever considered normal activities. Let's have a picture of what going downhill means. Anyone? Terry Solomon.
Some of the characteristics that we look for in the schools are changes, radical changes in kids, maybe going from a B average to a C average or a D, changing friends, groups of people that they hang around with, tardiness, skipping school, maybe a pattern of being sleepy in class after lunch, or missing Monday mornings, a change in attitude, not caring as much about what things that they used to care and dropping out of activities. I guess those are some of the
Mary
things.
Marianne, you're nodding.
Yeah, those are real good, Terry. And I think a lot of parents out there are probably saying, well, yeah, right, that's a symptom of adolescence. Adolescence is a traumatic time, and that's true. All of those things will occur at one time or another for a variety of reasons. But notice the word that Terry used, which was radical or exaggerated. In other words, it seems to happen overnight. They're strange people. The kids' old friends are no longer showing up. Or their old friends are beginning the same type of problem. And it's a very exaggerated thing. All adolescents want some free time and will isolate themselves from time to time. What you want to look for is the kid who locks himself in his room all of the time. You never see the kid. He's never available for family activities. There are some kids who still manage to make their curfew and still out there drinking and using other drugs. So there are a lot of things to look for. And our key point is, when in doubt, consult somebody. Ask. You know, if you hear some talk about drugs, ask some expert. Call them up. Have you ever heard of this drug or that? What are signs and symptoms? Too many of us go around looking for red eyes, and when we don't see red eyes or we don't smell alcohol, we think we're in the clear. Any resource person in this community, and there are many of us out there, would be happy to talk with you over the phone. Most of us do evaluations and assessments for free, so there's a lot of help out there, and it doesn't cost anything.
Paula, about changing behavior.
Yes, that I like Marianne's description. However, if you're a parent, as I was, who gets very enmeshed in your child's life, sometimes you don't see that radical change because perhaps you have blinders on, you don't want to see it. I didn't see it in my child. I had someone describe to me a very good description, I believe, and parents might want to think about this, a vehicle that's going out of alignment, and it's beginning to turn slightly to the left as you're driving down the road, so you in turn turn the wheel to the right to straighten it up a little bit. In our situation, our lives were going slowly to the left as our daughter was changing. Although she was and is a very smart young lady, and she knew how and when to use her drugs so that we wouldn't notice it as much. She never missed a curfew except for one occasion, which we thought was a rite of passage, and from that time on she was always in on time. She was very good about being around when she was expected to be around, going on family trips, participating, but she did begin to lock herself in her room more often, but after all, she was a 15, 16-year-old. Teenagers like their privacy. She liked to listen to her music. So we would balance what we thought was wrong. Well, no, that's what any normal teenager would do. She was going off to hockey games. She would come home happy. I now realize why she was so happy. But at the time, I did not. So it's a very frightening thing when, in some instances, if you aren't alert enough as a parent to notice this, the schools did not notice it with our daughter. No teacher, not one teacher, not one activity person that she was involved with, none of the people outside of school that she was involved in activities outside of school, not one came to us and said, "We think your daughter may have a problem." What happened was she was found at school using and was busted. And it was almost as if she were crying for help. I mean, what she did was really silly. It was a very foolish thing to do if, in fact, she wanted to continue to use drugs. So for those parents out there who are concerned about their children, and particularly the young ones, the ones that are in elementary school now, I highly recommend education. There have been panel discussions in this town. There are all sorts of seminars you can go to. There are, as Marianne mentioned, resources in our community to talk with if you're at all concerned about your child. Too often, things are available in the community, and parents like myself said, "My child would never get involved in drugs. My evenings are mine. I work all day long. I don't have time to go out to another meeting." So I didn't go, and I know from what I've experienced this year, not very many parents do go. And if parents aren't educated, and if the children aren't educated, this vicious circle is going to continue. We need, as parents, to be aware of what's going on in the community.
two people around this table are pointing to a book. You sitting in your living room can't see it, but Terry Solomon, tell us about this booklet.
Okay, thanks. This is the book is called Insights, What Every Parent Needs to Know About Alcohol and Other Drugs. And it's a booklet that was developed by two groups, the Alaska Council on Prevention of Alcohol and Drug Abuse and a parent group out of Juneau, National Council on Alcoholism in Juneau. And there's a lot of really good information in this book. The Substance Abuse Prevention Task Force through the school district, which is a community task force, is preparing this booklet to mail out to all families who have school-age children. And if I could, I could just go through and let people know what information is included in the book.
Sure, please.
There's a page that describes the problem and lists some statistics, including the risk factors, which are general characteristics of kids who are involved in drugs. Talks about why kids use drugs and some of the things that you can do to prevent that. It lists specific ideas on how to deal with it at home. It includes a page on red flags, what to look for, characteristics of children who use drugs, like we talked about, physical changes and attitudes and things like that. A check on attitudes, talks a little about denial, like Paula mentioned a little earlier about how we don't think it could happen to our kids, so we're denying the problem, cutting ourselves off from being open about it. Some of the attitudes that parents have, kids can't become alcoholics, my kid tells me everything, our family's really active in church and things like that. Another page talks about what is enabling, and maybe we could get into that in a little bit. That's a good topic to talk about. What to do if you suspect your child is using drugs and what not to do if you suspect your child is using drugs. And then we have alternatives regarding communications and what a parent can do. There's a page regarding information on drugs that gives a description of the drug, how long it lasts, the health effects, and the symptoms when you use that drug. And then we have resources, national resources, 800 numbers for information, and we are also including a page of Fairbanks resources where you can go to get help.
And I should say I've read through this since I've been getting ready for this program, and it's clear, concise, easy to understand, no great burden of information, and it's the kind of thing you kind of tuck next to the bed to take a look at every now and again.
Right. We'd like to encourage people to keep the book around, read through it once, and then you may want to refer back to it at some time. It's a really well-done pamphlet. It's got some eagles on the front, so you can be looking for that in your mail in the next week or two.
And is it possible for people who do not themselves have school-age children to acquire one?
Yes. If you want to call me at the school district office, it's 452-2000, extension 274. If we don't have enough after our mailing, we can probably get some more from Anchorage.
Okay. Let's take Terry's advice and take a look at enabling. Marianne, when we began this discussion, you were talking about enabling behaviors, it seems, in just our attitudes as adults about alcohol and drugs. Does that start the discussion?
Right. Enabling is a term that we kind of throw around a lot in treatment, but basically it means helping somebody's disease or somebody's addiction to continue rather than helping it to end. We all do that. We do that as parents and friends. We also do that as institutions, schools, and communities. Enabling means if I see a friend, a family member in trouble, I protect them from the consequences of their behavior. My child gets picked up in school. I run to the school and I say, hey, it was only a little bit of marijuana. Why aren't you out after some criminals? My child gets picked up on the streets and I go after the police officers that apprehended him. Or I get a lawyer, I get an attorney, I try to beat the rap, beat the consequences. Nobody ever gets better when things are going well. And what I hate to see is when I see a kid in trouble and I've got no hook to get that kid into treatment. In other words, the parents are being real defensive. The school is being defensive, the local agencies or other counselors or social workers perhaps are defending that kid's drug use. And we enable when we say things like, it's a rite of passage, everybody does it, why don't you go after some real crooks, why don't you leave my kid alone, my kid is a good kid. Every time we ever call a principal up and report our child off sick when he hasn't shown up, that evening. We do it for bosses. We do it for our spouse or our partners. Every time we run into the schools and say, you can't do this to my child, every time we interfere with a treatment facility that says this type of counseling is needed and we don't follow through, we don't take our children to the recommended program, then we enable the disease to continue. And once we do that, there's no hope for treatment at that time.
Then let's talk about intervention, hope for treatment. The other day, Marianne, you talked about it as benevolent coercion. Terry, I want to look first at intervention within the schools. You have programs or are implementing programs?
Yeah. A substance abuse prevention program is a really involved thing we're finding. It includes having a curriculum, which is the education part that the teachers teach every kid in the classroom at every grade. We also have, we have to train all the teachers to become more aware of the problem, including characteristics and what signs would indicate that a student is having problem. And right now we're doing that in the high school levels. We have a program called Project 714, and we've had an in-service where all the high school teachers were given a couple days overview of that program. We talked about enabling and alcohol as a medical aspect and some of that for a background. And all those teachers were given a behavior checklist. So if they have a student that's exhibiting some of these behaviors, they fill out the checklist and send it to a core team at their school. And this core team has had some more extensive training on identifying kids and running groups that help the children look at their goals, what they're doing with their life. It helps them be a little more objective. And they work in small groups with two facilitators. Anyway, the checklist, when they go to the core team will, if they get several observations from different teachers on one student, they'll probably identify him as some person that needs to be in the group to look at what's going on.
Then does somebody go find that child and say, you should come join us?
Right. The behavior checklist is nice because we don't have to say, accuse them of using drugs. Then you get into the yes, you are, no, I'm not routine. Mm-hmm. We can say, every day you are late in the morning. You always fall asleep after lunch. Whatever the pattern is, your grades have dropped from A's and B's to C's and D's. You're not on the basketball team last year. You were a star. Some of those characteristics. And we can ask the student to participate in this program and just to take a look at their life and see if it's going the way they want it to.
And this way, there need be no mention of drugs?
Right.
Huh.
It's done anonymously. We have a private room where the kids can go get out of class to go to this group. Nobody needs to know where they're going. They just go once a week, and it works out quite well. We have those groups going in three of the four high schools now. We also have, there's three different groups depending upon the situation that the child is in. There's concerned persons for people who are concerned about other people's drug use, maybe their friends or parents or anyone that they know that's using drugs that they're worried about. A support group is for kids who return from treatment so we can help ease them back into the school setting and give them support and let them continue looking at how their lives are going. And the other group is an insight group, which is mainly geared for kids who are using drugs. One of the things we're doing now is rewriting our violations policy, so rather than suspending a student for possessing drugs or being under the influence of drugs and in effect putting them back out on the street or back home and taking them out of the school setting, we would suspend them for a shorter period of time and refer them to assessment so we can see if they are indeed addicted to drugs and need treatment or if they just need a little more education or something like that. So we want to keep them in the schools if we can.
Is this, I just want to ask around the table, is this non-punitive approach to drug abuse comfortable, Chief Cummings?
Definitely the key to the drug problem is education, and it's not going to happen overnight. It took a long time to get to where we're at nationwide with abuse of drugs in our society, and education is the key. We're finding excellent results when police officers are in schools. The program that originated in Los Angeles, the DARE program, a drug abuse resistance education program, where the police officer goes in the classroom, fifth and sixth grade, and the junior high, and teaches, gets information about tobacco, alcohol, and drugs, and teaches students decision-making skills, and shows students that how to resist peer pressure, and that there are alternatives to using drugs. And that police officer brings a credibility to the of the knowledge of the drug abuse seen from a streetwise background, and also it brings the law enforcement or the police officer in a non-conflicting role, in a non-law enforcement role, a very education role. It's a very successful program. It's in the fourth and fifth grade. It's 17 visits by a police officer on a curriculum that is taught 1 hour once a week, and also in junior high, where it's where they reach the drug or the high drug or alcohol pressure using years. This program is already in Alaska. It's being used in Barrow and Wrangell and Seward, and I hope to have send a couple of officers out in the near future, either next month or September when the school's available, to a regional training center for police officers to train them in this curriculum.
So to integrate the police force with the educational system in an educational
right.
way.
This went in 1983 in Los Angeles. Now it's taught in every elementary school and every junior high in Los Angeles.
Mary Ann Terry was talking about groups primarily. Is group treatment ideal treatment? And Paula, too, I want your thoughts on this. Mary Ann Turkle?
I think it's the best for substance use, and I think it's the best for several reasons. One is once somebody begins using alcohol and other drugs, they begin to lie, they begin to cover up, rationalize their drug use, and manipulate everybody around them. Like Paula said, her child was using alcohol and other drugs for several years, and she and her husband didn't catch on. The reason they didn't catch on is not because they are unaware people or unperceptive people, but because their daughter became very adept in covering up. And it's the very unusual parent who learns to see through that, because we trust our children and we love our children. So once a kid gets real skilled at lying and covering up and minimizing, if I set up a counseling situation where one-on-one, especially one adolescent, one kid is with one adult, you can't ever break through and get anywhere because the child is using all of those tools with you and is lying to you and manipulating. And a lot of adult counselors get real caught up in that. They begin to buy into that kid's denial system, and they begin to become part of it. And pretty soon they become part of the enabling that we talked about earlier. They enable the disease to continue because they come up with, of course, Johnny's out using drugs. He comes from a dysfunctional home, or his parents are divorcing, or he broke up with his girlfriend, or they've been verbally abused or abused. Once you start looking for reasons, what you do is you give somebody an excuse for the behavior to continue.
And how does a group of peers short-circuit that?
If I put you in a group with other people who have gone through the same thing that you're going through, especially those a little further on in recovery, once you begin to bring out all of these excuses and reasons why you use and why you drink, the other group members step in and they say, I said the same thing too.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see the same sort of rationalizing behavior in you. What you're doing is making excuses, and they encourage that person to be honest. It's a lot more effective if it comes from another 14, 15, 16-year-old than an old fogey like me. They look at me and they say, well, that lady doesn't know what she's talking about. Look how old she is.
She's old.
She couldn't possibly. She's too old. She doesn't know what it's like, you know, to be there. If you hear it from another kid, if you hear it from several other kids, then you're on the right track. We have a saying in the treatment field, you can always tell when an addict is lying because his mouth is open. and I think we've all run into that.
Absolutely, yes. Go ahead, Terry.
Oh, I just wanted to make the distinction between the groups that we do in school and the mm-hmm. groups that Mary Ann does. We're not doing treatment at school. The groups that we have are just letting the kids open up and examine their feelings and looking at the goals that they have in life and being honest and just some, there's a whole curriculum that has specified activities for it. We don't pretend to do treatment. We're not in that field at all. When we see that kids are attending these groups, when they do that, we ask them to sign a paper, at least commit themselves to being clean and sober from one group meeting to the next. And if we find that they're not doing that, then that's an indication that they may need treatment. And at that point, we would ask them to go and have an assessment done at a treatment agency where someone like Marianne could interview them and decide whether they indeed need some more heavy-duty treatment.
Now, do you ask the youngster, or do you ask the youngster, call in the parents, consult, and suggest that that's what you think the best way to go is?
Most of the time, the parents are involved. We've just started these groups this year, so we're kind of learning as we go along, and as things come up, we call in the professionals to help us out doing an intervention. It kind of, most of the time in that situation, a parent would be involved. However, there are some cases when if the parents are heavily into drug use or alcohol or other drugs, there may have to be a way to have a person get help without the parents being involved. But however, we really do encourage the parents to be involved.
Can we take a few minutes, Terry Solomon, and look at the curriculum that is about to be put in the schools? It's in some of the schools now, right?
Right. It's in different stages.
Tell us about it so people can get a picture.
Okay. The reason it's all in different stages is some of it was underway earlier. The grant that I'm working for is called the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act of 1986, and this is the second year of that grant. The grant the purpose of it is to get programs started in the schools, not to take over a school district's responsibility for drug education, but just to help give an impetus at the beginning. We're looking at different curriculums, and right now we're training teachers to use the Here's Looking at You 2000 curriculum in the elementary schools. We have an elementary health curriculum that does involve some substance abuse objectives, but it's not as in-depth as we'd like it to be, so we're going to use this curriculum and beef that up a little bit. The Here's Looking at You 2000 series is a real good one. We've had 50 teachers trained, and all the elementary counselors. So about 10 schools have teachers trained now and are starting to use the programs at different grade levels. That program emphasizes information about drugs and their effects, skill building. The skills that we teach at the elementary level are how to ask questions, how to make friends, how to say no, with the goals of keeping your friends and having fun and staying out of trouble. Some of those things we seem to take for granted. We think kids know how to make friends, but we teach them how to go up and talk to someone when no one else is around rather than when they're around with all their buddies and things like that. So it's really well done. The materials are all available for the teachers. It includes a lot of varieties of learning, puppets, videotapes, discussions, problem-solving skills and things like that.
And gets more complicated and also more pointed as
right.
One grows in age and grade.
Right. You build from the beginning. In kindergarten, they teach about what is a drug, and if you find something, you don't know what it is, you don't put it in your mouth, you go and find a trusted adult that you can ask if it's okay to eat it. We talk about how pills and candy look alike, and so it's kind of hard to tell if you find something. And then each kid identifies trusted adults in their life that they can talk to and teach them how to dial 911 for help and things like that. I can go on to the middle school level. We're using a program we've trained teachers to use. It's a Lions Quest program called Skills for Adolescents, and that includes drug education. It also includes a lot of other things that at that level, self-esteem building, community service, goal setting, problem solving, and decision making skills. It's a real in-depth curriculum for the 10 to 14 year olds.
And in high school, the last couple of grades of high school?
In high school, we don't have a curriculum program as yet. Some classes, science classes, PE touches on it sometimes. It depends on how individual teachers handle it, but some classes have it. But we don't have a health program that is a requirement for graduation. So in the high school level, some kids get more of it than others. And the other program that I spoke about before, Project 714, has another part that's called Students Staying Straight. And those students can join a club, and they have activities where they're learning about drug use and saying no and developing activities for drug-free fun activities, dances and things like that. But that also doesn't hit every student.
Mm-hmm. Where's your hope level regarding this curriculum? Is it high hopes we can transform students in the course of a career from kindergarten through high school?
Yeah, I have a lot of hope for it, Susan. I think it's important that we start at an early age and build on up through the grades. But it's not something that we can just take care of in school. It's society's problem, and we all need to work towards making changes. Just looking around the table here, we've got a cross-section. We need to look at law enforcement and cutting off the supply of drugs. We need to work in prevention so we cut down on the demand for drugs. Each parent and each community person needs to look at their attitude and how much they let slide by and where they're willing to stick their neck out and make a stand.
I see some nods around the table. Other comments from folks?
I think it's very important for families to take a look at what's going on in their own home. I know in our family, after our daughter was actually found using drugs, a lot of reevaluation was done and has been done. Alcohol has been taken out of our home, and it's been a major part of our life for 25 years. My husband took a look at his use and has actually realize that he has an alcohol problem now, realize that he was using it far more than he needed to. I think there are a great many people in our community who believe that the cocktail hour is extremely important before dinner. Having wine with dinner is very important. It is part of our way of life, and for a large group of us, it is no problem. But for those who do have a hereditary problem in their family, they do have a history of alcoholism, they need to really take a good look at what's going on in their home. Perhaps their child is at risk, and if that's the case, as it was in our home, that child needed to know long in advance. Not that it would have stopped her from experimenting. I don't believe it would have. I think that the peer pressure is out there. And I think she started using things like Vivarin when she was quite young because, you know, one friend said, hey, this will keep you awake. You were out late last night. Let's try it. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of snowballed from there. I think it's going to be a long time before we can stop these youngsters from experimenting, but the education is the beginning of it.
Marianne, your read on this subject?
Absolutely. I agree with the other panel members because, as Terry said, you have to start somewhere. And this is a community problem. Chief Cummings can't do it alone if the rest of us are going to balk and drag our feet. Teachers, parents, none of us can do it ourselves, and certainly treatment providers can't. And I think this is the reason, as Paula mentioned earlier, you go to some of these lectures and talks on alcohol and drug abuse and you see so few people, even though that's something that everybody talks about. Why do you see such few people? Because a lot of us don't want to confront the reality, and the reality of the situation is when we start uncovering a problem, we usually have three or four more right in that same home that we never see, at least I have never seen, other than I think one or two cases of a kid using alcohol and other drugs who didn't have another family member who was chemically dependent. It runs in families, and it's real apparent once you start pulling the string that you're going to unleash a lot of problems. This is a community problem. The community has to agree on what we want. Do we want drug-free streets? If we do, then we have to put some money into that type of thing. Do we want drug-free schools? We have to put money. We have to put our support into those programs. We cannot sit around and say, okay, this is what I want. You guys do it. I want my beer. I want my marijuana. And I want it to be legal. And I want maybe some recreational cocaine use because I know how to handle it. I just don't want those people out there to have it. We can't do that. We have to put our money where our mouth is, I went to a conference some years ago by some real wise people who had gone through this very thing. It's a group of people in Canada, in an Indian reserve in Canada called Alkali Lake. And at one point, they were 95% alcoholic, and that was in the early 70s. One woman decided she didn't want to live that way anymore. Life began to turn around for her, and then her husband, and then slowly everybody in the community. So those people came, and they're 99% alcohol-free now, and they're willing to share what they learned. They had a big conference. A lot of us went to see it, went to hear, went to learn. We said, what can we do? What can we do? Because we want to see, we want to help you people. And they said, oh, the answer is very simple. Don't drink and don't use drugs. A lot of us don't want to hear that, but that's a real simple remedy. Where do kids get alcohol? They get it from us. Where do six-year-old kids who start smoking marijuana, like my clients do, where do they get it? They get it from mom and dad's stash. And then they get a little bit older and, of course, start getting the money and then start dealing and start buying cocaine and buying other drugs out on the street. Where do these dealers get the wherewithal to come in and to sell cocaine to kids or crack, which is cocaine to kids? They get it because they're making a lot of money on the adults. And I think Terry mentioned this earlier, we have to reduce the demand. How do you do that? You do it by education, but you do it by all of us deciding we're not going to buy it anymore. We're not going to have it available. If it's not available, people can't get it. And it's just a kind of a real simple thing. Unpopular, but simple.
Chief Cummings, your thoughts on this question?
It's definitely not a one-way street to solving a problem. There's many different avenues to take. From a law enforcement perspective, to reduce the demand level on the street is also arrest the user, the buyer, at the street level, not just worry about the drug kingpin, the one that is at the top. It takes an effort, a national effort, stopping drugs coming to the United States. But to support that is the education in our schools and, of course, at home, educating parents, and then parents opening up and talking to kids. I know my son was probably 7 years old sitting at the counter one evening when he was telling his friend, well, I want to drink like my dad. I mean, that right away tells me that my son is going to mimic me. He's going to, what my values are, that's my son or daughter going to have those values. Well, now my son's in junior high, and now my son is not only has those values that I instilled in when he was young, but now he's gaining values from his friends too. Could be good values or poor values, depends on the education I give him on excuse me, on making those important decisions.
An open question to you. Can a community the size of Fairbanks become an Alkali Lake?
I don't believe so. I would love to believe it, but I don't think so. No. Because, well, for one thing, you have quite a few people in Fairbanks who have absolutely no problem with alcohol at all. They may have one glass of wine a month. And that individual is going to say, come on, my one Friday night a month that I go out and have a glass of wine with dinner, you're going to tell me no?
Mm-hmm. Marianne, you brought it up.
Right. The interesting thing is, if something's not important to you, it's not important, and you can give it up. In other words, you can take it or leave it. If you are slender, then you very rarely think of dieting, and you very rarely tell yourself, oh, I can't afford that chocolate chip cookie, if it's food has never been a problem. Mm-hmm. If you're not a smoker, or you are an occasional cigarette smoker, and you have a cigarette, you know, once every few days or a couple a week, and something comes along and you can't get access to your cigarettes anymore, it doesn't bother you. When a substance begins to have emotional importance, you can't imagine life, a Friday night, a Saturday night, without a particular substance. And that's when we need to stop and take a look at that. Because if it is not important to you, if you have it, it's fine. If you don't have it, it's fine. And Paul is right. The majority of people drink with no problem. But there are, in our country, about 24 million alcoholics. We have a high rate of alcoholism in Alaska. We have a high rate of alcohol abuse, alcohol-related arrests, violence, suicides, and other deaths. So my point is, I think, for bringing up the Alkali Lake story, is that if something isn't important to you, then you ought to be able to give it up quite easily. if you can't give it up quite easily, maybe you want to take a look at that. And maybe it's not so hard to understand, therefore, why your child cannot give it up very easily, or why other people can. And I'm making a distinction here between use and addiction. And I'm also saying that we used to have this myth, and we used to say that, well, if you don't drink every day, or you don't drink a fifth a day, then you're not an alcoholic. And we've come to find out it doesn't matter how much you drink, it doesn't matter how often. What matters is what happens to you when you drink. And I think the first sign that you're beginning to lose control is when you begin to put some feeling, some emotion into that substance. I've had people tell me, so when did you drink for the first time? Oh, I was 13 years old, and it was 1972. It was like I said, when did you get married? When did you fall in love? Because that substance has created an emotional relationship. These people grieve when they lose it. That's what you want to look out for.
I can identify with this. When we went into the recovery center, there was a family week involved, and we were asked during the 7 days we were at the recovery center as a family, as adults, the parents, not to use any kind of drug or alcohol, which we did not. And then when we came back to Fairbanks and were going on a weekly basis to an outpatient family facility, we were asked during the 6 or 8 weeks we were involved in that program to abstain from using alcohol or other drugs. And that's when my husband had to take a good look at the ritual of coming home every night and having a drink. And it was something that he realized he was obsessed with. He had to have that drink. He looked forward to it every night. I'm the fortunate one. I didn't have to have that drink, and I, you know, very seldom did. So I feel very fortunate that it wasn't a problem with me. But Marianne's very, that's a wonderful way to put it. If it's something that you can't just put aside and not use.
The chief of police is here with us. We have just a few minutes left before we come to the end of our program. Each of you has, over the last hour, given what you feel, I'm sure, to be very important thoughts to people. I can tell by the intensity at which you say it. Is there a summing thought from any or each of you about teens and drug use in our town, in Fairbanks?
Oh, let me start, because I feel so strongly about this, and I make a point to say it. It's not a rite of passage. It's not okay for kids to be using drugs, and I'm including alcohol. As a matter of fact, never before in the history of humankind, with all of our experience, all of our lives, and all of the cultures and ethnic groups since history began, there has never been a culture where kids use drugs, let alone a culture where it's appropriate for kids to use drugs. And like I said, I'm including alcohol. So this is something that's happened over the last 30 or 40 years. So, again, it's not a rite of passage. It's not appropriate. The drug use that we think is appropriate for adults can and has killed kids. There are a lot of people out there that would have been alive, would have been in a lot better condition had we not had that ambivalent attitude. And if there's one thing I'd like to see our community develop, is the attitude that it's not okay and it's not acceptable in this community for kids to use drugs.
Marianne Turkle from Milam Recovery Center. Paula? 30 seconds.
I would just absolutely ditto everything she just said. Drugs are illegal. Alcohol is illegal, particularly for children under 21. They should not be allowed to use it, period.
Thank you. Chief Richard Cummings?
Well, in wrapping up, I'd say it's a community problem. It affects our home and employment, our life, and it's going to take a long time to turn around, but we better face it and say zero tolerance is not a dirty word.
Thank you. Terry Solomon from the school district.
Yeah, I'd like to encourage everyone to become involved. If not becoming actively involved in the community, just find out more for your personal knowledge. I'd like to invite people to a task force meeting that we have the first Wednesday of every month. It's in the school board meeting room at Main School. And our next meeting is April 5th from 4:30 to 6:30, and everyone's invited.
Thanks. Terry Solomon, Richard Cummings, Marianne Turkle, and Paula, I want to thank you all for joining me today on Sunday at Noon. I'm Susan McInnes, and thank you for joining us on Sunday at Noon. Enjoy your Sunday.